we're continuing our bicentennial series on political theory of constitutions, and in particular this morning on the mutual interaction and influence of the American and Italian constitutions and one another. As you know, we've been looking at this aspect of the relationship of the American Constitution to constitutions abroad in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and in Europe. And we're fortunate indeed that Roberto Tognati has been now, I think, on at least two occasions at the University of Virginia. Initially, I think, as a Fulbright visiting scholar at the Institute of Government, now the Institute or Center of Public Service at the University of Virginia. Dr. Tognati is a graduate of the law school at the University of Bologna. He's professor of comparative constitutional law at the law school at the University of Trento, and also the political science faculty of the University of Bologna. He's written on, and is now writing, in fact, on state constitutions within the framework of comparative federalism. He's editing a volume on the teaching of religion in the public schools, primarily in Italy.
Yeah, right.
He's been a fellow at in American Studies at Salzburg Seminar. He's been professor of comparative law at the International University at Lugano, Switzerland. Been a researcher of the National Council of Research in Italy, been visiting professor at the University of Galway in Ireland. He's published studies on the United States Constitution, foreign policy making, the electoral process, and so on, but also on the European Parliament, on the Israeli Constitution and constitutional law in Israel, and on Italian government and political problems and issues in Italy. So he's well qualified to address the question of the influence of the American Constitution, particularly in the Constitutional Convention in Italy, where choices were made that were undertaken in the light of some American Constitution practices. He'll speak for a time, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you very much. I think it's useless to say how delighted I am to be here, and I think I owe Charlottesville very much. I owe a wonderful 4-month period of research, and if I'm here in after only a short period of absence, I think it is due to the charm of the city, its people, and of course the facility of the UVA, which I consider an important part in my life. And you know, there's also one funny part of it, that you have a very rich collection of books on Italian constitutional law in the law library. And this is quite thrilling, as a matter of fact, as I wonder how many people make use of them. So I'm delighted to be one, you know, that makes that investment worthy, as a matter of fact.
That would help the legislators a lot. You're using their books.
Testimonial.
Just be sure you let them know. Yeah. Well, being a comparative constitutional lawyer, I have to say that talking about the influence of the United States Constitution on the constitution of one individual country is somehow mandatory. As I like to say that, as a matter of fact, the Constitution of the United States is part of the genetic patrimony of constitutions all over the world. It is sort of the DNA, you know, sort of basic information contained in most of the constitutions. Now, of course, there are families and various possibilities, groupings, constitutions, but certainly, for a certain number of countries, the cycle of constitutionalism starts historically as well as conceptually with the American Constitution. So in a way, it is not really difficult to argue that there has been some influence of the American Constitution on Italian constitution making. May I just add it, that if I'm not clear, please feel free to interrupt me at any time, as the language and the pronunciation may cause difficulties at being understood well. So please feel free to stop me at any time. So we're talking about the influence of the US Constitution on Italian constitution making, but as a matter of fact, I think that one can talk of a sort of ongoing influence of American constitutionalism and constitutional law on the development of Italian constitutional law. So it's not a process that was exhausted in a way in the moment when the Constitution was enacted in 1948, but it's a process that goes on, for instance, through the decisions of our Supreme Court and various other ways that we shall very shortly examine together. What is fundamental of the American influence on the U.S. On the Italian Constitution is the basic notion of the Constitution as the law of the land, as the basic law of the land, the supreme law of the land. As a matter of fact, this, I would say, is a major difference between countries that consider the Constitution as a political program, as declarations, but not as binding rules, as rules that may be enforced by courts. And this, I would say, is a great contribution that that many European countries are paying to American constitutionalism, and Italy is one of them. It's interesting to notice, for instance, that the first Italian constitution in 1848 was absolutely not influenced by the American experience, which had already reached about half a century of life. There was no influence whatsoever on the Italian as well as on other constitutions of the 19th century. But I would say that really the blooming of this influence comes mostly right after the war, and this is certainly true for Italy with the present 1948 constitution. Now there are many reasons, I would say. One of them perhaps is that due to fascism there was a number of intellectuals, Jews and non-Jews, that left the country and in most instances came to the States and studied and taught and worked here. So as they returned to Italy, of course, they were carriers of certain messages. One also has to bear in mind that to a great extent comparative studies were not encouraged during fascism, that is, in the 20s and 30s and early 40s. So many people who did study foreign constitutions found this somehow the only way of talking about democracy and about democratic institutions in a context that would not endanger their academic freedom. And then, of course, there was the cultural programs of the United States government, such as the Salzburg Seminar in American Studies and the Fulbright Program and so on. So, as I said, because of these conditions, Italy developed quite a trend in comparative studies, and I would say I'm a product of this trend. And therefore, the influence of foreign constitutions, including the American one, as I said, is a process that develops along with the development of Italian constitutional law. So this is something that we cherish very much. And I like to say that the law faculty of Trento, of which I am a member, is the newest law faculty in Italy, and it has been especially designed as a center for comparative studies. Every discipline is taught also in comparative terms, not only based on national law. And I say this just to emphasize the importance that we give to comparative law and comparative studies. But let's go back now to the main subject, and I think I have to make a few preliminary remarks that would help us understand how this influence is taking place. I remember there is an article in the peace treaty between Italy and the Allied powers that provides for for human rights clauses or human rights provisions in the forthcoming Italian constitution. So somehow, even before having a constitution, Italy was internationally bound to have human rights provisions. And this is, if you like, a first area of interaction between the American constitution and the Italian one. At the same time, I would say that the political freedom of the Italian Constitutional Convention in writing a constitution has been much greater than the compared Japanese and federal and the German one, the Federal Republic of Germany. In 1946. There were a few events that were basic in the process of enacting the Constitution. You have to remember that between 1943 and 45, there was a sort of civil war in Italy. The country was divided into two parts, the south, which had already been occupied by the, or freed, according to the points of view, by the Allied forces, and there was the monarchical government. In the north, the German troops were still there, and there were cooperating with the fascist government. So it wasn't really a civil war, but it was almost a civil war, and certainly the country was divided. Then in June 1946, there was a national referendum in Italy, and the choice was between monarchy and republic. Now, eventually, our choice was in favor of the republican form of government, but the majority was very narrow. It was about 700,000 votes majority. So that is a sign of a division in the country. And again in June 1946, there was the election for the Constitutional Convention, what we call Constituent Assembly. And that gave the full measure of the political fragmentation of Italy. And mainly, you can sketch out three main areas of political culture. One is the Catholic area, one is the social communist area, and one is an area which is very difficult to define abroad. We call it lay area, or that is secular democracy. And I can just indicate a few distinctions between these two areas, at least originally. When it comes, for instance, to the modes of production, the Marxists, the Social and the Communist parties were, of course, against capitalism. This lay area, or secular democracy area, was in favor of capitalism, and the Catholic then and now are still in between, in the sense they always advocate a third way between capitalism and collectivism. This, of course, doesn't mean that policy choices are compatible with capitalism, but from a theoretical point of view, there is this sort of uncertainty, let's call it this way. And then, of course, there were many other differences among the various areas. One of them, basic, I would say, is that what I call secular democracy is an ideology that recognizes the existence and the necessity of social and political conflicts within a body politic, whereas the Marxist and the Catholic are more inclined to favor a sort of harmonious development of society, either in the name of human and social solidarity or in the name of the predominance of one class above the others. So, you know, there are, I mean, all this is, of course, very simplistic, perhaps, but just to give an idea that there were indeed and there are indeed differences in the fundamental outlook of the various political forces. I say this just to emphasize the compromissory nature of the constituent documents, the constitutional document that was the result of the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention. And here is, if you like, the first moment of interaction between the wisdom of the framers of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and the wisdom of the Italian framers, who, in spite of all these difficulties, and I would say united by a sort of common reaction to the experience of fascism, found a way through compromise, found a way of achieving a document which could somehow accommodate the needs and the political ambitions of all groups, with one major difference, that the two big groups, the Catholics and the Social and Communist, could somehow dream of winning a majority, whereas the third group, the Secular Democracy group, has always been in the Italian tradition a minority group, although I consider it an enlightened one, and there is no need to say that I feel I belong to this third area. And I prefer to say this so I don't, you know, there are no implied values in my talk. There was, of course, also a fourth area, and there is a fourth area, which is the fascist group that existed in 1946 and still exists. And in a way, it is sad to say that they always, their electoral ground is on about 6% of the voters, so it is not negligible, although it is not really it's not having any possibility of achieving a majority. So I said a political compromise. A political compromise that is embedded, I would say, both in the frame of government, in the way institutions are disciplined, as well as in some policy areas. Why do I say this? Now, I say it because it's important to draw a fundamental, I would say, technical difference between the US Constitution and the Italian one. And here again is where the Italian experience seems to be quite far from the American one. In comparative constitutional law, a long constitution is not only long in terms of number of words, but it is long for the particular kind of rules and provisions that it contains. And these rules and provisions mostly are policy rules, so that all European constitutions are not only a frame of government, as the United States Constitution, but are sort of comprehensive documents, legal documents, trying to bind the policymakers to certain fundamental choices or values. In this, I would say the Italian framers felt the European influence much more than the American one. It is true that the first long constitution is considered to be the Mexican Constitution of 1917. But at the same time, it is true that certainly it's the Weimar Constitution, the German Constitution of 1919, or the Spanish Constitution of 1931 that set a model to be later imitated by many European constitutions, including the Italian one. So what is interesting, if we examine this phenomenon, is that I see here something which did occur in the United States, but not at the level of the federal constitution, but at the level of states' constitutions. We call this period the period of rationalized constitutions. That means that mostly right after the First World War, many relationships between institutions and relationships between the state and individuals were not left up to, let's say, political balances, but were enshrined in rules that were part of the Constitution. For instance, the vote of confidence. Until 1919, the vote of confidence as the fundamental instrument that regulates the relationship between Parliament and the executives was left up to political balances, the king on one side and Parliament on the other side. But it's only after 1919 that the subordination of the executive to a vote of confidence of Parliament is the object of a rule, of a legal rule, of a legal provision. And so in many other areas, the behavior of institutions is disciplined in a very minute way, I would say, in a much more detailed manner than in form of government type constitution such as the United States one. And the other area which is typical of long constitutions is the one of social and economic rights. Here you have for the first time, for instance, I'm talking of Weimar in 1919, but of the Italian constitution in 1946, you have the inclusion of rights such as the right to welfare, to social assistance, to protection of maternity, protection. I mean, there is a rule in the Italian constitution that may seem very funny, as I think we are considered a rather lazy people. And there is an article which says everybody has a right to one day of holiday every week, and this right cannot be bargained. It's very funny as a way. It seems that holiday becomes more a duty than a right. But anyway, I'm very glad we have it, although I'm not really sure we need it. And then again, the first article says that Italy is a democratic republic founded upon labor. And many people, not only foreigners, think instead it's a republic founded on strikes. But it still works. So I would say it still works, notwithstanding Article 1 of the Constitution. So what happens is that what the progressives mostly achieved at the level of state constitutions in, for instance, having provisions concerning special legislation, special interests, the need to regulate railroad industry, banking industry, all the blue sky laws, for instance, and all the voting democracy devices such as referendum initiative, popular recall of elected officials. So a number of instruments of democratic government are present indeed in state constitutions and are present in national constitutions in European countries. So I do see similarity in this area. But if I talk of policy rules, as you understand, the need for political compromise was very acute. And again, here's where the wisdom of the framers did work, in the sense that some fundamental rules were laid down in which all the political cultural areas could identify themselves. What I call secular democracy, the communists, the socialists, the Christians. And at the same time, these rules were flexible enough to give to future legislators the task, and I would say the burden of overcoming political conflicts, of defining precisely, for instance, the limit of private property, or to what extent, for instance, a state monopoly of a certain economic activity may be admitted or not. I'd like to go into the actual text of these rules with you, but I'm afraid that time doesn't allow us to do so. But it is very interesting, as again, I would say that the same technique that has been employed in Philadelphia in 1787 has been employed, that is, to some extent, defer choices. For instance, there is one rule which says for 20 years Congress shall not pass any law concerning slavery. So this is what happened in our Constitution. They said private property is protected, but it must perform a social function. So everybody agrees on that. But then what is the social function of private property, what are the actual limitations, is deferred to future legislators and policymakers. And again, many areas such as the voting rights in the American, in the federal constitution, were left up to the states, somehow decentralizing the choice and deferring it in time. And the same thing was done by Italian constitution makers. So this was supposed to be a sort of introduction to, you know, just a sort of general atmosphere, general background of the making of the Constitution in Italy. And I think that already we have a few symptoms of interaction. But if we go to further examine some basic choices that were made by the Italian Constitution makers, we see that this influence is even greater. And my idea is to try to analyze with you today three areas. One is the area of the form of government, the second is the area of judicial review, and the third is the area of regionalism and federalism. and I do hope I'll have the time, although I doubt it. Now, when it comes to the form of government, I'll say right away that the same group that I call the Enlightened Left did put forward a formal proposal for having a presidential form of government, with the president elected by the people and accountable to the people, and a bicameral legislature. So it was a proposal that went very much close to the American institutional machinery. This proposal was not accepted. It was not accepted, and I think there was good ground for not accepting it. There was this political fragmentation I talked to you about that was very high then and is still very high now. Plus, we had had about a century of experience of monarchy, and we had had about 25 years of experience of Duce, of Mussolini. And the fear of a strong executive vested in one individual was very high. In the way the Hamiltonian notion of strong executive was always regarded, and somehow is still regarded in Italy, as almost coincident with fascism. Now, of course, all this is translated into our own political culture. And one also has to bear in mind that all the power was then in the hands of political parties. And political parties, of course, did not want to renounce their role as mediating structures between society and institutions. Since then, the proposal for establishing a presidential form of government has been put forward several times, but every time it has been labeled as a fascist solution. And I think really that there is, and this of course has nothing to do with the American experience. Nobody's saying that the American president is a fascist president. But the fear is that the Italian version of a president might be a sort of temptation to an exercise of power, rather discretionary and not respectful of democracy. So the choice was made, and then, you know, there's again, let's say, a fear of even of any electoral system of the type winner takes all. So we have a very strict proportional representation system that makes Italy closer to Israel, for instance, than to France or Germany. And we have right now, I think, about 14 parties represented in parliament, some of them consisting of one or two representatives. And it is, as you understand, very, very fragmented. It is true, though, that students, for instance, of comparative law have a very clear perception of presidential powers in the United States as immense powers. They always say, I hope before taking my course, that American presidents have enormous powers, huge powers. And you see, I think this is interesting because the perception of the presidential form of government is rather unclear, I would say, and goes in the direction that I just mentioned. And this explains the fearfulness of this particular form of government within the Italian context. So the choice that was made by the Italian constitution makers was to take from the American experience principles such as separation of powers and checks and balances. And this, I would say, as principles, are fully incorporated within the Italian constitution. But when it comes to the actual form of government, the choice has been in favor of a parliamentary form of government, so that we have a sort of division of disidentification between the head of the state and the prime minister. Now, the head of the state is the president. The president does not share executive power, somehow is a figurehead, somehow has only ceremonial functions, but we believe, at least I believe, it performs a sort of role of constitutional guarantee in, for instance, performing powers such as the appointment of the prime minister, the dissolution of parliament, the appointment of one-third of members of the Supreme Court, and the like. But the executive power is vested into one council of ministers headed by prime minister. So in this way, Italy is like Great Britain, Germany, or Spain. But at the same time, because of all the fears I've been talking about, and because of, the fear for concentration of power, and because of the political parties' fragmentation in parliament, we differ. I mean, we are different from Great Britain, Germany, and Spain because we don't have a strong prime minister. We have a very weak prime minister who is mostly a coordinating political figure, but he has no power, for instance, of choosing the ministers. Ministers are imposed by the political parties joining the coalition. The prime minister has no power of dismissing a minister. And the like. So it is a very weak collegiate form of executive. Sometimes the proposal to change something is put forward. As I said, there is a proposal for having the president, that is the head of state, elected by the people and not by parliament, as it is now. But even this limited reform is regarded as with very much suspicion, because that could give a higher role to the President of the Republic against the wishes of most of political parties and political thinkers as well. So this for the form of government. Now the second great area of inspiration, I would say, of the constitution makers in Italy in 1946 has been the whole field of judicial review. Now, for the talks about introducing judicial review were took place in Italy even in the 20s and 30s, and they were always rejected. The European continental legal culture, as a matter of fact, has always rejected the idea of judicial review of legislation. It was very hard, mostly coming from the French Revolution experience. It was considered very singular, very unusual to limit the will of the majority of the people as represented by Parliament. And the law, and judges have always been regarded, using the phrase of Montesquieu, as the mouth of the law, nothing but the mouth. The interpretive role of judges has always been considered very limited, very, very limited. And therefore, having an institution that could disobey a parliamentary statute was considered out of the system. And here is where, at least in Italy in 1946, the influence of the American Constitution was felt very, very much. And I think that just, because of the American experience, judicial review was eventually introduced into the Constitution. Again, it was a political compromise. Socialists and communists absolutely rejected the idea of judicial review. And it is quite obvious, as for ideological reasons, they couldn't conceive that the will of the majority of the representatives of the people could be overcome by a selected number of few old, or not so old, but anyway, generally regarded conservative men and women, perhaps. And they were, as I said, socialists and communists opposed it very much. Plus, they were still thinking that they could gain a majority of parliamentary votes. Therefore, they didn't want any counter-power. The Christian Democrats accepted the idea, although they were not so enthusiastic about it, but they thought it might be one more instrument for preserving power. And the lay parties, the secular democracy, were the ones really in favor of judicial review. And this, I would say, is the battle that this particular area of political culture won during the works, the proceedings of the Constituent Assembly. At the same time, though, there are many models of judicial review. There is the American one, there is the Austrian one, basically speaking, and Italy made a choice in favor of the Austrian model. That is, there is only one judicial institution having the power of declaring an act of parliament contradictory to the Constitution. Whereas in America, every judge may not enforce a statute as he believes is contrary to the Constitution. In Italy and in Austria and in Germany and in Spain, all judges must suspend the case in front of them, send the question to the special court, and the special court will declare whether a certain statutory provision is consistent or not consistent with the Constitution, and then we'll send the case back to the judge from which the question originated, and the case will decide that particular case. So we do have a case and controversy clause in our Constitution, as you have in Article 3. And we don't have what the Austrians and the Germans call the abstract control of constitutionality. That is, right after a law is enacted by Parliament, you may ask the Constitutional Court to review it right away, irrespective of an actual controversy in front of the judge. So we don't have that. But at the same time, as I said, we have only one institution, that is what we call the Constitutional Court, which has the power of declaring an act of Parliament contradictory to the Constitutions, to the Constitution. And the power that this institution has, the Constitutional Court as we call it, is the power of repealing that particular statute. So this is a sort of legislative power in the negative. So the court cannot enact a provision, but can repeal a provision, and that particular statute disappears from the statute book. So this, let's say, the Italian version, of course, there were also political reasons for choosing this particular method. And one of them was, for instance, that in Italy, as elsewhere in continental Europe, judges are career judges. They enter the judiciary right after law school, or maybe perhaps a little later, but they are judges throughout their life, and this is their job. So Italian judges had been trained and had performed their functions during the fascist period. So there were problems of what we call constitutional loyalty of judges. That is, if every single judge would be called upon the duty of applying or non-applying a statute with regard to its conformity with the Constitution, will they do it or not? Will they acknowledge that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, or will they not do it? So the idea of having a concentration of power from this point of view in one single institution also had a political background. It was a compromise, as I said, between the various solutions available. What is funny is that right after the enactment of the constitutions, roles reversed. The social and the communists, who had opposed the Constitutional Court, advocated its immediate functioning, whereas Christian Democrats and secular democratics said, no, it takes time, this is a very burdensome process, it takes a lot of prudence before we do that. And for 8 years, there has been no Supreme Court working and performing this role of judicial review of legislation. So this is what has been called obstructionism of the majority, that the majority did not implement the Constitution. And this, again, was a sort of development from the initial compromise of the Constitution-making period. I said that the influence of the United States Constitution does not exhaust itself with the proceedings of the Constituent Assembly, but is an ongoing influence. And the ongoing influence, and I don't think I need to spend many words on this, is on the controversial role of constitutional adjudication and judicial review of legislation. That may come up if you're interested in some questions. But certainly, let's say, the Italian experience follows the American one in the controversial role of the judicial review of legislation in several areas. Although I would say that the Italian Constitutional Court is more consistently following society, following majorities, and in a way it's a more conformist, let's say, institution of judicial review than the United States one. Now the third area, very briefly, concerns, as I said, regionalism and federalism. Again, the secular democracy group advocated a more marked federal structure for Italy, although there were objective problems of national unity. There, as you probably know, cleavages between the north and the south. There are areas which have different degree of development, and probably a federal solution might have caused more problems to the building of the new state right after the war. So the choice was in favor of a regional structure, which is less than a federation, but it's much more than what is considered an administrative decentralization. So Italy is a unitary state, but it has achieved a political decentralization in the sense that regions are allowed to make their own policy choices in a number of areas and have the power of enacting laws that have the same force of law of national laws, but only apply to their territorial jurisdiction. Now, the areas, of course, are very limited. They mostly have to do with the organization of local government, with the powers of the various institutions of regional government, with economic development, social and public services. So in all these areas, the 20 regions have powers, as I said, of making policy choices. For the rest, national laws applies all over the territory. One has to say, though, that this political decentralization is not really achieving results which could not have been achieved by a federal structure. Now, of course, there's no talk of state sovereignty in Italy. There's no such a thing as regional sovereignty. But certainly there is a trend for more and more claims of autonomy, autonomous powers, autonomous funds, and or rather autonomous capacity of spending public funds. There are basic differences between regions in Italy and states here in the United States. There is no constitution. The constitution is approved by the national parliament. There is no power of enacting laws, for instance, in criminal matters, in any of the basic human rights. There's no power of taxation. So all the money that regions are free to allocate are funds coming from the national treasury, collected from the national revenue, and then allocated to various regions. There is a power of the central government to veto regional laws, and the last word about regional laws vetoed by the national government may go either to the Constitutional Court if it is a legal issue, or to Parliament if it is a political issue. There are no courts. There's no regional court system as you have states' court systems here. So let's say structurally there are very basic differences between regionalism and federalism, but by the way it works and by the kinds of difficulties that arise out of political practice, I would say that there are great similarities. So again, as in the area of judicial review and in the area of regionalism and federalism, the technical choices, the actual legal provisions are different, but political process are very much alike. And this is, again, where similarities may be found and where the influence of the U.S. Constitution is not only limited to the moment, to the historical moment of adopting the Constitution, but also to the political process of implementing and developing the Constitution. I'm sorry I took a little longer, but thank you very much for your patience.
Who would like to ask the first question?
I'd like to ask one. In discussing the comparison between the two constitutions, which I think you did a very good job of explaining and telling us the relationship, how many amendments have there been to the Italian constitution since it was formed?
Only three, as a matter of fact. Well, we only had it for 40 years. Mm-hmm. So it's not really great.
Well, we had 10 the first year,
so. All right. Well, you just knew you were going to have them right away. Well, as a matter of fact, there has been no need for formal amendments to the Constitution. Interesting enough, one basic amendment, has to do with problems of federalism and regionalism. One of the ideas was that the Senate, we have a bicameral parliament, and a proposal was to have the Senate as a chamber of regions, where each region would be represented with the same number of senators, irrespective of the population, very much according to the American Federal Senate. The proposal was not wholly endorsed, and the only regional ground of the Senate is that the electoral district for the Senate coincides with the region and not with a special electoral district. But for the rest, the Senate is not really a regional, I mean, doesn't reflect the regional institution at all. Originally, though, the Senate was supposed to have a term of 6 years as opposed to the 5 years of the Chamber of Deputies. But after afterwards, as you know, political balances might be broken. And so that is, I would say, the only major constitutional amendment.
Speak very well for that.
You know, I was going to ask a related question. What is the process of amendment, and does it have any relationship to the United States Constitution?
Yes, somehow. In the sense, the procedure is based on national parliaments only, so that regional parliaments are not really, I mean, do not play a role. If the national parliament approves of an amendment with the majority of 2/3 of votes, if a majority of 2/3 of votes in national parliament is not achieved, but only an absolute majority, then 5 regional parliaments may file a petition for a national referendum, and voters will ultimately decide whether that constitutional amendments will be approved or not. So regional governments as such don't have any other power than to file a petition to have a referendum take place. That's the only role in the amendment of the Constitution. So they are present somehow, although they don't have the final votes.
And how did these amendments come about? Were they carried by the 2/3 vote originally, or did they have to use the petition from the...
So far it was always achieved with the 2/3 of votes, mm-hmm. Yes.
But the other provision is there.
Yes, it is there. It is there.
Bill Wemple, have you had a big volume of constitutional litigation about the constitutionality of laws. We have books, rooms full of decisions on it's the favorite sport of a large part of the legal fraternity in this country, you would think. Does it happen often?
Yes, very much. And as a matter of fact, thanks to those library resources I mentioned, I'm able to give you some data that I found in a magazine here. And
I didn't mean to get citations. No. Go ahead.
Never mind. Well, it is really a considerable amount of litigation, and it is growing, let's say. This is also an important thing to say. For instance, in 1976, there have been 840 cases. In 1985, there have been 1,013. So as you see, in about 10 years, there has been a considerable increase of about 50%. One of the problem, and let's say that also may be an interesting datum, that is about, I mean, less than 10% of cases involve regionalism, and most of them involve fundamental rights, individual rights. So as you see, somehow regionalism does not take a great share of the work of the Constitutional Court. It's rather fundamental rights. But there is a very, very huge increase in constitutional litigation. And so it is, I would say, a permanent feature now of the Italian constitutional system to bring about cases to the court for judicial review of legislation.
If the litigant loses in the parliament, and he goes to the courts.
Well,
that's done here a great deal.
Well, I don't think it is done in Italy. That might occur if we had adopted what I call the abstract control of legislation, as they do in Germany, for instance, or even in Spain. That right after, or in France, mostly in France, mostly during these last 10 years when there have been changes in the majority. As soon as a statute is approved of by Parliament, they go right away to the Constitutional Court. And that doesn't happen in Italy. And I'm very glad, as that would turn out to be sort of almost advisory function of the court. And that would make it more difficult in later stages to give a different opinion about the same piece of legislation.
Professor Fernbaum?
In the spirit of your broad view of the constitutional development, can we turn for a moment to political parties? The drafting of our constitution didn't involve the thought of parties. And you pointed out the importance of the parties in the drafting of your constitution. Would you make some comparison of the role of parties and also of the role of special interest groups?
Well, are you referring to the early periods of the report?
Or today.
Or today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's put it this way. The major division in the early days of the United States was between Federalists and Anti-Federalists.
After we had the Constitution.
After you had the Constitution. And what is striking is that although, of course, these two different groups did give different interpretations or were inclined to give different interpretations of the Constitutions, when, for instance, Jefferson became the president and the Anti-Federalists sort of took over, they did implement the Constitution with a high degree of loyalty to the document itself. So there has been a rotation in roles, in majority and opposition, and there has been a fundamental respect for the Constitution. In Italy, we have not really experienced any rotation in the role of political parties, parties that had the majority in 1946 or 1948 still have the majority. And minority parties have never become the majority, so we have never really experienced the same degree of loyalty to the constitution, as we'd say, that you had. What is true is that, as I said, there has been a sort of obstructionism of the majority in implementing the constitution. So they wanted, I mean, the Christian Democrats and lay parties did want judicial review of legislation, but then they waited 8 years. They did want regional structure, but then they waited from 1946 to 1970 and 75. I mean, that's more than 20 years, you know. So somehow the constitution, if the constitution has been betrayed at all, it has been betrayed by those who advocated those particular institutions. And this is very unusual. And for instance, the Communist Party became the strong defender of the constitution when they realized, for instance, that they could win the majority in at least three regions in Italy, where they had the majority since 1948. And that is a sort of red belt which cuts Italy in sort of two halves. And again, the communists had been against the Constitutional Court, but then when they realized that they could achieve the result of having at least one, let's say, communist-oriented member of the Constitutional Court, they became defenders of the Constitutional Court and they attacked the Christian Democrats for not establishing it, you see. So, from this point of view, I don't think you can really make a comparison between a system such as the US one that experienced rotation and the system that did not experience, as we did not.
What would you say to the efforts of the United States to introduce schools of thought or disciplines that would study such things as the political party system? After the war, World War II, there was a good deal of communication, as you know, largely through Prime Minister Einaudi, who was, for instance, the representative of one of the foundations in all of Italy. Edgar Channon probably saw some of that, but he would recommend to an American foundation who should be encouraged to study politics. And one argument was that the legal view of society and politics didn't give you much impetus to study parties and electioneering and some of these issues. So men like Ferrarati and others allegedly jumped into the breach and studied the way politics actually worked as over against pure constitutionalism. Has any of that continued, or has that dissipated? Or one thing I always thought, I was involved in some of this, one thing I always thought was a blessing was that no single school of thought gained dominance, even in the Red Belt. Mm-hmm. Why Il Molino, for instance, was not dominated totally by the dominant, the major group, majority group in Bologna and elsewhere. And similarly, Florence and Rome and Venice and other places had movements in this direction, but they didn't take over for the whole country, as we have a tendency. If we get a Harvard University for years in government was noted for traditional political history and theory. Now all of a sudden, the department has, correct me, has really become the capital city for public choice approaches to the study of politics. And they've almost wiped out these more traditional approaches. And the rest of the country very often tends to follow that lead. But it didn't seem to happen in Italy, and I thought that was a good thing, that you had these multiple centers of thought rather than a single view. But I wonder what it's like today.
Yeah, I would say it definitely is. Also, very much to my own comfort, I should say. You see, this, of course, has to do with the distinction of what we call areas of political culture. And these are much more significant, for instance, than distinctions in single political parties, as obviously every single area of political culture is then divided into many political parties. Mm-hmm. But this is part of the political process. But from the cultural point of view, there are some homogeneous group, I would say, and they all have their own shall we say, brain trust. And this is very vital, I would say, to the furthering of studies. Being a constitutional lawyer who teaches also in a political science faculty, I do experience some difficulties with my political scientist colleagues. And being a constitutional lawyer who teaches in a law... being a teacher in a political science department gives me difficulties with lawyers, and teaching in a law school gives me difficulties with political science colleagues.
Maybe you're like one of Dr. Shannon's colleagues, Charlie Cole used to say, who was president of Amherst for many years, that he was an economic historian, but the economists called him a historian, and the historians called him an economist.
Right. So that does give a little bit of disciplinary problems, let's say. But from the point of view of pluralism and what we call laboratories of ideas and studies and research, pluralism is a permanent feature, I would say, of Italian academia. Yes, by all means.
Any other questions? Well, we're very pleased that Professor Tognati could be with us today. We hope that his two visits in recent times will not be the last. And what he has given us, and he's in a very few days, has taken our invitation very seriously in working out a clear and systematic approach to the problem, is useful for U.S.-Italian relationships, but I think it also helps, gives us a framework for thinking about other European-American relations. So we're very grateful to you.
Thank you.